Today, we are all invited on a special tour of a secretive lair where some of the world's greatest engineering and entrepreneurial minds plot the campaigns of a global empire. The place is Mountain View, California. Prepare to go in the Plex. Welcome, everyone, to Beyond the Book, Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series on the business of writing and publishing. My name is Chris Keneally, and joining me today is Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex, out this spring from Simon & Schuster. Stephen is a senior writer for Wired and previously author of several books examining the goings-on in Silicon Valley, including Insanely Great about Apple and Hackers, Heroes from the Computer Revolution. Thank you for coming on Beyond the Book, Stephen Levy.
It's my pleasure, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have the opportunity to talk to you because you've written a book that really goes back to the very beginning of Google, and indeed, you were there right at the start. I think that's just so remarkable. You first wrote about Google in February 1999 for Newsweek when you were there, so more than 12 years ago. And the company still runs a top-notch internet search engine, but it does so much more, of course, selling ebooks, developing operating systems for smartphones, neither of which were even around or thought about in 1999. What do you think about how much Google is the same company it was in 99, or is it simply unrecognizable from those very early days?
Well, as you point out, it does so much more. Though I think it's still believed that search is as core to what it is and as core to the mission of Google, which is to gather all the world's information, organize it, and make it accessible. That still means something to it, even though sometimes they have to stretch to encompass some of the more ambitious things that aren't search that they do there. I think what keeps it Google and googly, which is a term they use a lot, is that they try to do things in the same spirit, with the same mission, with the same values that they did when they started the company. And those are the values of the internet and to do things fast and to please the user there. These are still values that matter at Google. So it's recognizable in that sense, even though it's a huge company now and certainly casts a giant shadow on the rest of us that it didn't in the earlier days.
Well, yeah, I think that's what's remarkable and what's so engaging about the book. You don't have to be a technology aficionado to really want to take a look inside and find out what makes Google tick. And again, I mentioned you've had this incredible relationship with the company going back to 1999, and that's afforded you a kind of access that almost no other journalist has had. And for this book, I understand you spent 2 years inside the Googleplex, figuratively and literally. Do you ever wonder whether you've overdone it, you know, spending more time with with one company than it ever really deserved? And I guess that's my way of setting up the question. Why is it important that we understand Google today, whether we are in the media, in technology, or simply sitting at our desks and we need to find out something?
Well, it's really hard to imagine a company that has a bigger effect on us in our daily lives than Google does. It's not only the go-to place for information, but it affects how we're using computers in the future, from its mobile use, and it's leading the way to the so-called cloud computing movement there. Shapes the way that we're going to be dealing with information in the future. And I think just as an organization, as a company which models itself on the internet, as I said earlier, is changing the way business is done in the company too. So I felt that it was worth all that attention. And in terms of being there too much, I had to pull myself away from my interviews to actually write the book, because as I got into it more and more, the interviews became more and more productive there, because I was so deep inside the interviews I was having, especially halfway through and towards the end of the research, turned out to be so much more fruitful, because people very quickly would start talking to me almost like a colleague while still understanding I was a journalist there. But I'd learn more and more about it and get deeper into this company, which really is unique in a sense.
Well, yeah, and that's obviously the sort of desired state for a journalist, to be in that place where you're not quite invisible, not quite the fly on the wall, but able to share in an experience and understand it deeply because you're sort of attached to it.
Yeah, and very much so. And I think people appreciated that, beginning with my first book, Hackers, I spent a lot of time with people in the engineering sense, and I was sort of interested on how that stuff works there. I came to understand the products of Google are characters in themselves in the book, and to understand how search works and how the Google ad model works gives you insight not only into those products, but the people behind them and the values behind Google and what's possible in an age where you could get control of huge amounts of information and in a very quick way and use it to do business in a way we haven't seen before.
Well, you know, the book opens with a scene that's going to be familiar to many of our listeners. It takes place in Judge Denny Chin's New York courtroom in 2010, and it's around the class action lawsuit brought by authors and publishers against Google for copyright infringement. And you write about the shock that was felt in Mountain View, the surprise that and the hurt that authors and publishers would attack Google for an effort that they considered to be so high-minded. Why do you think that suit, which began in 2005, was such a watershed event for the company?
Well, I think it represented something that illustrated the shift of Google in the public perception and and the realization that people had outside of Google of the power this company has over them. Here was an initiative that Google engaged in, and the people at Google who started it felt that it was something that everyone would embrace. What better thing than to take all the books ever published and make them instantly searchable? As someone who used to be a grad student who would go down literally like four or five floors beneath ground level in the library of the university I was at, to look at books, and sometimes they'd be there, sometimes they wouldn't, and sometimes you have to go somewhere in a library alone to find something, just to type something into a little box and have Google find something in a book that you never heard of that was published 40 years ago, it just popped up there. That's kind of amazing. And those are the kinds of things that the people at Google, Larry Page in particular, the co-founder and now the CEO of Google, thought of in this project. They thought, who could object to that? Well, it turned out people did object to it, largely because they were suspicious of Google, and they knew that Google made a lot of money, and they felt that Google was going to be making this money on their backs there. And that's where the book search initiative ran into the big problems, and really continues to run into problems to this day. We still don't know how that story is going to end, but we do know that Google didn't get what it wanted, and the ideal had to be put aside in a way because people didn't trust it anymore.
Yeah, it is remarkable, and I think that shift, which you document pretty well, the way the company changes over time from being kind of cute to being something quite different, is a really important part of all of this. One of the characters who appears, apart from the co-founders often enough, is Tim Armstrong, now CEO and chairman of AOL. And he served as the ad chief for Google over most of the last decade. Can you talk about his relationship with Brendan Page while he was there, and do you know what that relationship is like today?
It was a pretty interesting. So he represented the kind of person that came in who wasn't an engineer. He was someone from the sales side. He did embrace their approach to selling ads, which was to discard the traditional way of saying, we're going to expose the ad to a certain number of people. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't work. In this case, Google said that we're going to sell ads that people want to see. We're going to be able to track them all. And Google had this odd relationship to its sales force, where it knew they were necessary, but didn't consider them in a way equal partners to the engineers in the company there. So Tim sort of straddled those two worlds there. When he first started in New York City, he really worked out of his office in the upper his apartment in the Upper West Side. And when he wanted to buy a fax machine just to confirm the sales buys, which was the way things were done back then, Larry and Sergey questioned this expense. They said, "Well, are you sure this is going to be worth it? We're going to get faxes in to justify this expense. They even watched it for a while there, and of course now Google has, you know, thousands of salespeople, but their relationship is different than the traditional relationship. They're more consultants to help people figure out how to buy these ads and how they work, rather than to take people out over dinner or golf and try to convince them on the basis of personal relationships that this is a good idea to give your ad budget to us instead of other people. Google wanted to quantify these things, and this is a model which has caught on, and now Google AdWords is the dominant form of advertising on the internet.
Right, right. Well, I wanted to ask about the perception the engineers have about this tremendous source of wealth, which is the ads, and you're getting at part of that, this special relationship and the special approach that the salespeople had. But inside the Googleplex, what do the engineers think about this source of wealth?
Well, it's seen a little differently. It's a little surprising. I come from the journalism world, where we see ourselves on the editorial side as sort of kings, and the business side sort of supports us. Of course, the business side, they see us as, you know, people who spend money, where they're people who bring in the money there. So, you know, everyone feels that they're really responsible for the enterprise. At Google, there's no question the engineers are in the center of it, but they see the ads section as also an engineering center. They think that they're making innovative products in engineering. And indeed, if you look at what Google does in its ads, there's a lot of technical accomplishment in there. There's artificial intelligence to figure out how much they're going to be charging for those ads that appear on the side of the page there. They're sold by auction, but it's not an auction where the highest bidder necessarily wins. There's an algorithms that are figured in there determine the price to get paid, and they have to use AI to do that. They also have to use a lot of technical expertise just to do that, and the speed they do. Google does literally thousands of auctions every second. Every time you type your query into the search box, not only does Google search the web to find out what results are relevant, but they hold an auction for that term to see if there's anyone bidding on a term or something similar that would make their ad relevant to your search.
Right. And, you know, this is Chris Keneally. You're listening to Beyond the Book. We are chatting with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. And since you've spent so much time in there, I want you to take us inside the Googleplex. We should probably tell people what we refer to there. But what would we see? Who would we meet? What would we eat?
Well, you know, we could start with the food. You know, when I was doing the book, I think they had 18 cafes on the main campus in Mountain View, California. Now, I think I was just there a couple weeks ago. It's up to 24 cafes, and it's delicious food of all sorts of, you know, different cuisines. Healthy food. Braised beef, cheeks, and all kinds of the strange stuff, as well as, you know, just sandwiches and things like that. And of course, it's free, and you can get it three meals a day if you like. And you can't walk too far into the office space. It's an open area with a lot of medicine balls and fun things strewn around. But you can't walk too far without going into what's called a micro kitchen with other kinds of food and snacks and, of course, gourmet coffee. Everything is really designed to take the pressure off people who might worry about, you know, just subsistence kinds of things, and let them concentrate on their work there. So you could have, you know, you bring in your laundry and you dump it into a bin there, they'll do it for you. There's doctors on campuses. Every so often a truck comes up with a hair salon, so people can do their hair appointments there, and, you know, dentistry and anything you want can be done pretty much on campus there. The work, though, is intense. People spend a lot of time coding, of course, and they spend a lot of time in meetings, and even that Google has to a science. They try not to let meetings go on too long, and when you go into the conference room, everything's taken care of. There's chargers for any kind of computer you might have. They have a standard sort of video conferencing system that no one has to sit and futz with it for minutes and minutes before you get going. So they try to think of everything to take away the distractions and let people just get to work.
Right. Well, you know, of course, the company was founded, begun at Stanford, and many of the early employees came from that environment, that elite campus environment where I guess, you know, they work hard, they play hard. Is that about what it's like at Google?
Yeah, it is. There's two strains, I think, in the culture of Google that are really important. And one of them, as you say, is the university idea there. And, you know, it is very much campus-like, not only in the amenities, but in how they argue things. You know, the job interviews, some people say, are almost like defending your dissertation. You'll go on there. And there's a lot of colloquy and back and forth, and they try to keep it based on data. The other strain in the culture is... comes from, I think, the fact that both founders, Larry and Sergey, were Montessori kids. So there's a streak of irreverency, that go on there. They question authority, and it's okay to ask any question of anyone, even the founders. Once a week they have a meeting, an all-hands meeting where anyone could attend and ask any question that they want. And, of course, Google has a system, where people can submit things online and vote them up and down, but they could also answer questions, ask questions directly, and sometimes the questions are quite pointed straight at Larry and Sergey, and they don't take it personally. They'll try to answer the questions very straightforwardly, and no one really worries about whether you're offending Larry or Sergey when you ask a pointed question. I remember I was at a meeting once, at a TGIF meeting, where someone asked, why did our CFO get so much money? Why do we have to spend so much money to get a chief financial officer? And Sergey, thought for a minute, and he said, well, basically, we looked at it and we felt that this was a going rate for CFOs, and we wouldn't get a good one otherwise. And the other person sort of stood down and said, no, okay, that makes sense. And, that's a good answer there. And they wanted the next thing.
Right. Well, what's fascinating about the book, you've got so much in it, but there is one thing that's not in it, but is covered on your blog and via the blog to Wired.com, and that's the newest offering from Google, what we now know as Google Plus. It's really the up-to-the-moment story, and as you said on your blog, you were privy to all of it while it was being developed under a code name Emerald Sea, but you couldn't write about it because it wasn't yet released. What's the level of importance that Google executives are giving to this new social media project called Emerald Sea?
I wasn't able to include in the Plex sort of the run-up that Google's troubles with social networking and its concerns about Facebook, but not talk about the details of the product itself, which came out. And when it did, I was able to put a 6,000-word blog post, essentially.
Right.
It was like a Wired article up it was released. It really is very important to Google. And people at Google told me that they felt that this was the one epic fail, as one person called it, in Google's history. They've done a lot of things right over the years. They've done search right. They've done ads right. They were smart to buy YouTube. It was smart to do a mobile phone system, but one thing they didn't do that would have been a smart thing to do would be to master the social networking aspect, to build people into their products, as they put it. And after a number of false starts and failed products, they felt that this was really do or die at this point. They came up with the biggest initiative in Google's history. It touched almost every product in the company. We've only seen the beginnings of it with Google Plus now. There's a lot of shoes to drop, but they came out with this thing. They thought it could do it in 100 days. It took almost a year, but they're delighted at the response it's gotten. And I think that says two things: that the successful field test they've been doing with Google Plus, and one is that the thought they put into it has paid off to a certain degree. And another is that maybe people are getting a little restless with Facebook and they're willing to look at an alternative. And Google is pretty happy about that. I don't think they mean to kill Facebook, but they want to just get in the game so they can get the same kind of valuable information about users that Facebook has.
Right. It's an interesting transformation of what the word information means. When they began, it was what was online. Then they looked at the whole book project as a way to bring other kinds of information into the results, and now they're trying to bring the people information in.
Right. Well, you could look at it. There's more broadly interpreted. Gmail had personal information that people didn't share with others, but they were able to store on Google, and Google did search through that information. The algorithms did, not people, to deliver ads to it. Google bought Blogger, which was information that people did share with other people there. But they never really built an infrastructure to share like they're doing now. And I think that they want to have people share with them like they share with Facebook. And maybe somewhere along the line, Facebook and Google can sit at a table and decide that with the user's permission, people can share that social information between other systems. I think that's what Google really wants, not to kill Facebook, but to get hold of the same kind of information.
Well, that's interesting, because so it's not necessarily that Facebook is keeping Google awake at night, but I think there is one source of fear that might disturb people's dreams, and that would be the attention they're getting from governments around the world, from the United States government and from countries in Europe and elsewhere, who fear that Google is a monopoly or is becoming a monopoly. What do you know about what Google is doing or what they're thinking about these fears and how they hope to distract the regulators or allay those fears?
Well, they really can't distract the regulators. The regulators, Google has the full attention of regulators now. The FTC and the European Union are both investigating Google to see if it is a monopoly there. Google has a good argument, a better argument than Microsoft really had during the 90s, that they say that we don't lock people in and people can go elsewhere for information. But Google has a lot of power, and as we talked about, it's not just in search. It's in a lot of other areas there. So I delve a lot into the politics there, not only in terms of the regulatory and antitrust, but Google's difficulties in China, which they compromised the morality, I think, by going in there and agreeing to censor their search results, which was a giant compromise for them. But then they came out finally and said, for a number of reasons, and not just that they were hacked by what was apparently the government in China or people supported by the government, but a whole other series of other unfortunate consequences coming from their censorship led them to realize that they don't want to do that anymore, that it wasn't worth it, and they pulled back. And I think even though you can question it from a business sense, from a moral sense, everyone at Google feels good about that. And I think that's important to know, that still matters at a company, even when it's the size of Google, that keeping your moral standards is more of a challenge when you're a big company like that, but it still matters to them.
Well, it's been a fascinating opportunity to learn about what goes on in the Plex. We've been chatting today and Beyond the Book with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex, out this spring from Simon & Schuster. Stephen, thank you very much for chatting with us today.
Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.